My intention today is to continue our hearing on House Bill 3072, then go into work session on the latest version of our Lifeline Universal Service Bill. See how far we can get on that. At least bring the committee up to date on some of the discussions or suggested changes in it, and then discuss the provisions of House Bill 3162, which have been incorporated at this time into the Lifeline Bill 2663. I think we're going to need some discussion about several of the items in there, such as who is going to administer the program, who's going to collect the money. We need to take a look at, we've all indicated a desire to accomplish what 3162 does, but we haven't really given detailed attention to the language in it, and I think we need to do that. It would be my hope that, although I haven't talked to Legislative Council this afternoon, my hope that we will have a subcommittee meeting tomorrow at 3 o'clock out of Energy and Environment, and that perhaps at that time we could send the bill to the full committee. If we run across things we can't resolve by then, we'll just have to keep working and waiting. But and that might be the case with some of the provisions of 3162, but I'd like to focus on those if we could. First, I'd like to have where open the hearing on House Bill 3072, and let me first call Mr. Ed. Are you representing the commission on this? We all get too familiar with each other.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
We have exhaustively, I have put my head in that figure looking at this particular bill, came up with a stack of problems and gave them to PNB. They put them into amendments. And as far as he was concerned, he thought that the number of changes were so many that this needed quite a bit of time. I was reminded by the chief of our proceedings division that the law had been rewritten, the utility law had been rewritten earlier in 1974, I believe. The legislature appointed a committee that held 40 hearings over a period of 18 months to rewrite the utility law, and this takes about that amount of, or greater amount of rewrite. Being a Jeffersonian, I believe that that less law is better than more law, even if it's the same. But that's a personal belief. I'd like to say that there's a difference between the telephone industry and the energy industry. The telephone industry has 2,000 or 3,000 pages of tariffs for one company, and with the access charges, maybe 800 or 900 pages for each company. The industry has many more different kinds of services and different problems than the energy industry does. On the other hand, with 2200, we wrote a whole lot of legislation, the legislature did, that applied only to telephone, and I think quite successfully. The telephone utilities have the ability to be de-tariffed, deregulated in that bill, and there's quite a lot of reason to believe that the utilities, as far as the distribution of telephone services, still are utilities and ought to be treated in the same way as gas or electric utilities. That's all I have.
Representative Anderson.
I'd like to ask Ed or make a statement or whichever that I think just separating the thing, and a big argument's been made for it. And I believe the Legislative Assembly in the late 70s or early 80s started D6 all the statutes. And we've carried through that every time we deal with an issue, we make changes. And it would seem to me that even though your head, your knit head picker or head knit picker or whatever, a lot of things wrong with it, I would think as long as this amount of work has gone into it, which is rather extensive, that we might at least make a start and carry on as other things are flagged in future sessions and eventually accomplish the end. I don't know that we have to tell the whole world that all of the telecommunications statutes are now together in one section or one law, but just comment on that maybe. How would that adversely impact people who deal with telecommunications?
Representative Ekus, Representative Anderson, in reality, if there is no change in the law, this creates a body of statutes that is by itself for telephone. The public utility was blessed with that earlier in this decade, I believe, when we had two sets of laws for the motor transport division, because there was a belief that they were going to move part of those people from the PUC over to the transportation division. Then later on, that didn't transpire, and we would get amendments to one set of the laws and not to the other. And then the next year we would come in and correct that. And that became such a mess that the legislature in its wisdom repealed part of that so that there's only one set of statutes for the motor regulation. That's one of the things that the legislature, which I'm sure will be vigilant to do, is to, if they are going to change the way utilities are regulated, all utilities, then they'll have to amend both sets of statutes. That would be the only difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Bob Gray, did you want to add something?
Representative Ekus, members of the subcommittee. My name is Robert Gray. I'm an attorney with the law firm Preston, Thorgrimson, Ellison, Holman in Portland. I'm appearing today on behalf of MCI Telecommunications Corporation. MCI is certified by the Commission as a competitive telecommunications provider. MCI offers total telecommunications service at various locations throughout the state. As you know, my testimony concerns HB 3072, the bill that was introduced at request of PNB. I'd like to pick up on some of the points that Ed made. MCI opposes adoption of 3072 for several reasons. First, no matter how carefully drafted, a bill as comprehensive as this one invariably results in changes to the existing statute, whether those changes are intended or not intended. In this case, we've been able to identify an example of a change in the current statute, even after the bill was carefully reviewed by the Commission staff and Legislative Council, and over 46, I counted 46 corrections to the statute were made as a result of that review. We believe that disputes over interpretation are inevitable if HB 3072 is enacted, and resolving these disputes will consume resources and time at a point when the transition in the telecommunications industry is already consuming a great deal of Commission staff time and industry resources. Second, we believe that the comprehensive changes such as HB 3072 should only occur if there's a clear purpose and policy basis for such changes, and that purpose has been articulated. We have not seen any such basis established with respect to this legislation, We do understand that PND has proposed 3072 because it does not want to have to request exceptions from proposed utility legislation when it believes that the legislation should only apply to electric and gas utilities. However, we do not believe that this is an adequate basis by itself for rushing through a comprehensive change in the statute. There may be cases where telecommunications utilities should be distinguished from electric and gas. However, as PNB is a telecommunications utility and continues to provide utility service, we believe there is no inherent reason why that section of the statute should be distinguished from the electric and gas sections. And we do note, as Ed pointed out, that there have been substantial changes to the telecommunications provisions, and those changes have been made even though the sections have been consolidated in the past. Third, and Ed alluded to this also, it is our understanding from the Commission staff that the last time a comprehensive reworking of the telecommunications statute occurred was in 1971 or 72. However, those comprehensive revisions only occurred after a 16-member advisory committee held over 40 meetings and then recommended a series of changes to the statute. The advisory committee mandate was limited to updating the existing statute. Each change was carefully considered and explained. It is our understanding that controversy over the so-called innocuous changes in that legislation continued for many years after that statute was finally adopted. And I brought along a copy of the advisory committee report that came out of that process it's a copy from the Supreme Court Library, and you get an idea of the amount of work and care that went into that comprehensive revision, and in spite of that work and care, there was still a fair amount of controversy within the statute. This is a very carefully laid out revision.
Sure. Question, and either you or Ed could answer this. This earlier revision in 71, did it make substantive changes? Was it designed to make substantive changes, or was it?
My understanding is, was it primarily an attempt to, quote, modernize the statute. It was not an attempt to principally make substantive changes, but Jack Sokolowski is quite familiar with the process, and Ed probably is.
Chairman, there were, as I understand, no major substantial changes at all. There were some minor procedural changes that were made. The language was updated, and that was all there was. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green.
Mr. Green, let's go back to your first point. That although the intent is not to change anything in substantive law, some things may fall through the cracks, and there will be changes. Can we cure a large percentage of these, say, corrections or problems by adding a section to the bill dealing with construction of this new law or this new statute, saying the courts will look at the prior law in terms of construction?
I've thought about that a great deal, because I've tried to figure out a way that you could draft such a section to avoid the ambiguities. And I just don't know the answer to that question. And I could not provide you the assurance that such a section could be drafted in all honesty, and I have tried to draft one myself and haven't been able to come up with one.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that? One of the things I think Mr. Gray's concerns are good is that every so often, every 30, 40 years, we revise the ORSs. And I worked with Sam Haley after he revised the ORSs in 1951, 1953. And they go word by word, and there's still problems. And, Mr. Chair, I believe that within maybe the next 2 years, in 10 years, we'll probably look at the ORSs again for further revision. And these are some of the issues we'll have to look at. That was a comment, not a question.
Representative Anderson.
Well, comment, I guess. I would think that a attorney or lawyer or whatever would have a large interest in not simplifying type of things in the statute.
That thought has crossed my mind. My clients are not well served by the confusion, unfortunately.
Thank you.
The problem is when you get more than one attorney revising the statute.
As I mentioned, there is a specific section in HB 3072 which contains a substantive change from the existing statute. That change is found in Section 16. Section 16 specifies that rates charged by utilities are lawful until changed pursuant to certain specified sections of the utility statutes. The existing law contains different statutory references than HB 3072. HB 3072 specifically excludes a reference to the detariffing section of the statute. That reference is specifically included in ORS 757.225. And I will say that I spoke with Mr. Burko at the staff and Mr. Sokolowski and Mr. Morrison, and I tried to reach Mr. Huss yesterday, but he wasn't able to return my call. But to discuss that change, and they just simply said, the people that I spoke with just simply said it was just missed. It is clearly a substantive change. It came up, at least in our discussions of the deregulation by definition controversy or proceeding last year. We believe that the reference in 757.225 to the detariffing section was important because the legislature had amended 757.225 to add a reference to detariffing, but did not amend the section with respect to services offered by utilities. We believed at that time that if the legislature intended to deregulate the section to exclude certain services offered by utilities, it would have further amended the section. Further, the reference to rate making sections in Section 16 of HB 3072 is to its sections 1 through 70. Existing ORS 757.225 states that rates are lawful until changed pursuant to 10, not 70, specified sections. It is impossible to determine now what arguments will flow from those changes. The point, of course, is not that a particular change or that a particular section contains a variance from the existing statute. That could be conformed. The point is that invariably there will be substantive changes that result from a comprehensive reworking of the statute such as this. We believe, again, if such a comprehensive reworking is to be considered, it should be done on a systematic basis after a policy basis for the change has been clearly articulated and agreed to. Finally, we should note that if there are any changes in the type of those contained in 3072, you would have to conform your lifeline rate proposal and your and the MCI bill to the changes, which require some further reworking. At least that's my belief, looking pretty quickly at those bills. And that's really all I have to say.
There's some amendments proposed already to conform.
That's I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to present this testimony, and of course I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Could you say, Ed, could you come back up? Was it legislative direction that created the revision in 71, 72?
I can answer that. Ed can answer that once I give him the forward here.
Joint resolution was in 1969 regular session of the legislature.
Did they create a task force, or did they instruct legislative council, or? It doesn't have the resolution, it just refers to the resolution?
I believe that they probably resolved that a advisory committee should be created to come back to the legislature in a specified time with specified changes to affect the purposes that are set out in the resolution. I wasn't there, but.
Wasn't either. Still in a bar in college. Okay, any further questions?
Thank you.
No, thank you. Anyone else at this point that would like to testify on 3072? Now we'll close the hearing for the day on 3072, and we'll open work on House Bill 2663. David, Pat, and Ray, and Eric, and Maury, and Do you want to kind of come forward so we can, and George, if you like to, you can just move up to the table there and we can all, yeah, it's okay, we'll all stay there. But, in a line, yeah, meet those folks that, so we can all be involved in the discussion on this. Well, yeah, we need to move this mic here. This point, the bill with you, as well as some of the changes that were flagged or suggested at a working group meeting this morning. Essentially, as we discussed before, the bill, the legislation, has become a general universal service approach, contains several sections to it addressing different issues. The four issues that are really combined in here are the sort of the Lifeline monthly assistance program to low-income individuals, a deposit and installation plans that would remove those as much as possible as barriers to having a telephone, the provisions for a medically in need certificate to prevent shutoff, and inclusion of House Bill 3162 for the TDDs. Section 2 declares a general policy of the state. We discussed some language change that would change it from the policy is to provide adequate, affordable residential telecommunications service to customers who have limited resources available for obtaining telecommunications service, to something along the lines, we don't have specific wording from legislative council, that would is the policy of the state to assure adequate and affordable residential telecommunications services available and obtainable to its citizens, something along those lines. Section 3 gives the commission authority to that's needed to address two of the major concerns, which are the deposit and installation charge review and the monthly assistance plan. Section 1 Section 3 sub 1 requires the public utilities to provide time payment plans for deposit and installation charges, and I think key language is, or such other options as may be appropriate for a particular telecommunications public utility. Essentially, this allows the commissions essentially to review the deposit and installation plans with the goal of availability of service and removal of deposit installations as a barrier to obtaining service. Would not require time payment plans for deposit and installations because it does provide other options. It may entirely be possible to look at the charges and that the companies have and say that time payment plan isn't necessary. In some cases, some companies are moving at this point to essentially no deposits except for certain at-risk customers. So sub 1 tries to deal with deposit and installations as a barrier. sub 2 is necessary to give the commission authority to have a differential rate or discriminatory rate that it would use in its monthly assistance plan. It also gives them the authority to continue the existing telephone assistance plan until another plan is developed to take its place. If any of you out there want to add anything as I'm going through this, please feel free to do so. This is going to be a pretty loose work session. We did discuss changing in line 19 limited resources and going with low income rather than the words limited resources. Sub 3, in conjunction with that, would allow the commission to establish plans or to require the utilities to establish plans for educating customers regarding the options available. And sub 4 is what we discussed before, sort of the open door for other approaches. References made in 26 is in lieu of participation in the low-income assistance plan. That is low in section 5 sets out the monthly assistance plan. What we have discussed is referencing sub 2 and sub 4, which deal directly with the plan that's discussed in section 5 later on. We would add language that would reference that specifically to that, because that's primarily what it's... As I went through this bill, I realized it's a little different for me. I'm used to being at point C and referring back to point A and B in legislation, and this bill has a tendency to be at point A and referring to B and C, so it was a little hard for me to
is
get.
Is that a problem, Ron, to have that refer forward? It seems to me as long as it's in the same statute.
It's not a problem. It's just different, and at times it's been difficult for me to follow. So I just want to point that out for other people that might have this difficulty following it. I don't believe it's, there's no legal problem. I'm usually used to the other way. But we do need to reference sub 2 and sub 4 to section 5, I think, when we discuss that.
Well, if you use the term low income, doesn't that then make that reference, because you define that term in a later section?
Yeah, it is defined only as used in this section. It is not defined as used in this act.
Mr. Chair, what was the discussion on the difference in the terms between low-income and limited resource?
Well, the problem arose in the previous draft when low-income was defined in the first section of the bill as food stamp eligible. And then everywhere it referred to low-income in the bill, you were then tied to the food stamp eligible. The food stamp eligible was only intended to apply on the monthly assistance program. And in some of the others, it was not necessarily intended that there was an income criteria specified in the bill. I don't believe it's a problem to use the word low income. I don't believe it's a problem necessarily to use the word low income and to not define it except where you need to have it defined. So I think we're okay there, but as long as the PUC has the authority to define low income wherever it needs to in relation to a program. What I want to avoid is where we've kind of gotten rid of the where everything had a reference to low income. The only specific definition of low income is in the section 5. That's been a problem with the construction of this all along. Section 4 incorporates what we had previously adopted under the medically in need medical certificate. We had one change from the previous language, which was in line 20 on page 2. We had previously had a specific reference, I believe, to 12 months. We've had some discussion in a working group that whether it should be 6 or whether it should be 12. We just settled on general language allowing a commission to establish it, because it may not necessarily have to be the same as it is for the energy utilities that have a similar program. So we've left that up to the commission rather than specifying that in the bill. Representative Anderson.
By loosely using the attorney position, where are we with the term naturopathic position, osteopathic position?
Line 15. David or Pat, what do you do in the energy? Do you use the word physician in the energy?
We use, because we do use the word physician, and it's loosely construed.